What this is a sound recording thingy. I've been recording the talks that I've been doing as I've gone through Australia. I'm thinking of calling this tour Rampage Across Australia. I've been going to, this is, I guess, the fourth city I've been in, and I've been met with sheltered heathen, and he's a witch, and, well, not exactly like that, but I am coming at the topic that I'll be talking about from a bit of a different perspective. You may have gathered that from the title of this talk, which is E-Learning in Easy Pieces, a title I regretted almost as soon as I wrote it, but, you know, once you've sent it, it's too late. I'm going to keep things really informal, as informal as you can with PowerPoint slides. I would like to have just gotten online and tootled around a little bit, but that's okay. I mean, the URLs are in the slides. The slides will eventually be on my website. My website's at the end of the slide, so if you need to find out where to find the slides, just have a look at the last slide and you're there. Not even a difference. Oh, man. So here we go. Wee, isn't this fun? Everybody gets to watch me play with PowerPoint. Do feel free any time during the talk to interrupt, ask questions, heckle. He said turn off your phones. You can turn them back on if you would like. I don't mind the competition. It's, you know, sort of like market awareness. If I can't hold your attention while you're sitting in the room, I need to reassess my delivery style and my content, so I'm not too worried about it. E-learning in Easy Pieces. Let me first ask, how many of you, this is such an awful question to ask, how many of you have heard of me before? Okay, less than half. That's why it's not an awful question to ask. How many of you have been to my website? Okay, now I'll give you just a wee bit of background then, because I've been involved in e-learning more or less since 1987. It wasn't e-learning back then. It was working the telephones. I did some work with audiographics. I did a lot of work in person, driving around in northern Alberta, doing First Nations communities. Mostly I taught philosophy and logic. My experience in northern Canada back then has its similarities, I think, to a lot of your experiences, because it was remote regions. The roads sometimes were passable, sometimes they weren't. And I'd go north not knowing when exactly I'd get back, because you never know when the weather's going to turn. And when the weather turns in northern Canada, you just camp out where you are and you wait, because it's completely white out and like real cold and so on. So you don't have the real cold. I do imagine you have the white out, or I don't know what color it is when it's pouring rain. Gray out? Gray out. So my background, and I've never had any money.
Oh. Yeah, you have.
So, you know, I've been working in e-learning all of this time, and my record of getting grants is like pathetic. I don't get grants. I work with a project called EduSource in Canada. That was a big grant, but I kind of like hitched a ride with other people who are good at getting grants, and then spent the 2 years of the project fighting with them. So, well, it's not really the case. So a lot of the work that I've done in e-learning is what I refer to myself as guerrilla e-learning. When I was working at Assiniboine Community College, I started at Assiniboine Community College. That's in a city called Brandon. And if you imagine a wheat field approximately the size of Western Australia, and you take a town of about 40,000 people and you put it right in the middle of that wheat field, that's Brandon. And so it's a little community college. It's got maybe 1,000 or so students in that, a bunch of instructors, because you need those. And I went there in 1995 to work on e-learning, and they told me, well, you can't have a web server. Network won't support it. Right? How many of you have heard that before? So I use bulletin boards and things a lot. So I got myself some web server software that actually ran on Windows 3.1. I installed it on my desktop, and I tweaked it around a little bit, and then I walked down to the computer services office, and I said, fire up your browser. This is running off my desktop. And that was the end of that complaint, and they had to give me a web server because I had proven that it could be done. I'm sure your experiences are similar in many respects. And so, over the years, because this introduction does have a point, the sort of work that I've favored has had to be a little bit underground, a little bit subversive, definitely cheap, not always sanctioned by the people who are in charge of things. And I've developed an attitude as a result of that, because I've been at this now for 10 years, and I still don't have very much money. And the stuff I do, even right now, on my server, I have a server. I actually have a fairly good server. It has no disk space, but I have a good server. But the stuff I do has to be stuff that I can create using Notepad, I can access using a simple browser, and I don't need a degree in computer science to understand, because I don't have a degree in computer science. I probably never will. I have degrees in philosophy. So my theory is it has to be simple enough that a philosopher can understand it. And that's probably ruined me with the philosophical community. So this is e-learning in easy pieces. And now I'll start my talk. We've got, 5 minutes? This is not a new theory, I don't think, but the way I look at technology, and I'm sure other people have said this too, I'm sure I can't be the only one, technology advances when technology advances, and of course it's never inevitable, but when it does advance, it advances in two stages, as you can see on the screen. The first stage, the new technology comes in, everybody goes, wow, yippee, yippee, and they use it to emulate the old technology. Right, we'll use this new technology to emulate the stuff we can already do. And you see the examples there. When refrigerators first came out, they were thought of and actually were ice boxes, right? Because they were replacing the ice box. So let's make this thing that does what an ice box does equally well. When cars first came out, they were horseless carriages. The second stage is a lot more interesting, because in the second stage, you actually understand a little bit about the technology, and you realize, oh, this gives you a whole lot more that you can do than the old technology did. So I threw a few Canadian references here. Refrigeration technology takes us beyond mere ice boxes. It takes us to ice makers. You know, those things in the hotel, and they sort of every once in a while, and it pops ice cubes. Or Mr. Freeze. Never would have had that before the refrigerator. Or the Zamboni. Oh, you don't write, of course. Oh, Mr. Freeze is wonderful. It's something that could only be invented in Canada, where we have the least of all need for it. Basically, you take, it's sort of a tube of plastic, and you take something like slush, and you put the slush in the tube of plastic, and then you freeze it so it's practically solid. So you have a grape Mr. Freeze in this little plastic sleeve, and then you cut off a little hole in the corner, and you spend the next hour... Pardon? A what? Okay, well, there you go. I'd hate to think of Australia without them, because, I mean, if any place needs them. I'm pretty sure you don't have Zambonis, though. If you're wondering what a Zamboni is, a Zamboni is a thing that looks and sounds an awful lot like a tractor, and it's basically a machine designed specifically to resurface the surface of a hockey rink. A hockey arena. So they actually have trucks built for that specific purpose. And all it does is people skate around and make little holes in the ice. And this thing comes along and floods the ice and smooths it all off. That's what it does. Never would have had that before. And the people who invented refrigeration, they were not thinking Zambonis or even Mr. Freeze. or whatever you call them here. The people who invented the internal combustion engine were thinking horseless carriage. They probably weren't thinking coach. Well, maybe a little later they were with stage coaches and that. But they weren't thinking transports, or as we call them, 18-wheelers. I don't know if you call them that here, but we do. And they certainly weren't thinking 747s. So, e-learning right now is busy finishing up the first stage. We're getting ourselves to the point where, using technology, we can kind of do what the old technology did. And the old technology was pretty much what we've got here, right? People sitting in chairs, person standing at the front of the room. We'd be fully old technology if I was drawing squiggles on a board or something like that. Come on in. And so I'd like to thank you all for coming to this talk. Oh, I love doing that. Right now in e-learning, we've basically gone through this process of replacing the traditional classroom, the online classroom, things like Centra Symposium and so on and so forth. Some of them even have the little buttons you click and put up your hand. Online courses, and I know you've probably all seen online courses in WebCT or Blackboard or whatever. They look just like traditional courses in structure with a cohort of students and a start date and an end date and classes and modules and lessons and little quizzes, just like we do in a class. So you pull a pop quiz online. Textbooks and exercises, those old standbys. We've got now learning objects and similar bits of technology that are intended to replace these static bits of content that we used to work with. And we're pretty well there. We're not completely there. As famously been said, the future has not been evenly distributed. So, it's more in some places, more in others. State of the art. All of these links here, which I can't click on, which is just as well, because they're big, huge PDFs, all come from a conference that was held here in Australia. I believe it was in Adelaide about a month or so ago. This is the state of the art. Interoperability. Getting things like your learning management system to work with your student management system. These large yeah, I know, but we're coming to that. As I describe it, big pieces tightly joined. It's like the way Windows works tightly with Word, works tightly with PowerPoint. Only you do that on an enterprise-wide scale. That's the model. Frameworks, technical architectures, common services. It's the strangest thing in the world of especially enterprise computing these days, and especially e-learning. They don't release software anymore. They release what's called a reference implementation. What a reference implementation is a bunch of code and routines and so on that doesn't actually do anything. And what happens is, you have to take this reference implementation and then somehow, through the miracle of Java, do stuff on your own system to make it work. So we have all of this. We have a complex technical architecture, and if you follow the link here, you'll see the sets of services, and there's like 30 boxes of common services and so on and so forth. We have repositories. Of course, you've probably seen the Learning Federation and EDNA and all of that sort of stuff. And in our neck of the woods, we have the EduSource project, and south of the border, there's Merlot, there's NSDL. All these are they're big libraries containing learning resources. I ran a link in my newsletter not too long ago. Microsoft has a library like this with something like 1 million objects in it. Cisco has one. They have to be better than Microsoft. So they have 1.4 million objects in it. And these huge libraries. And the search mechanism that's set up is what's called a federated search. And if you're wondering what a federated search is, basically I, as a searcher, submit a search quiz, and then my search is what they call federated, which means a copy of my search is sent to each of the separate repositories. So I do one search, and then it propagates through the network, and it gets repeated 20 or 30 times, or however many times you have, or however often as you have members of your federation. And of course, to become a member of this federated search network, you have to have not only content, but some means of authenticating the searcher so that, you know, only legitimate searchers are allowed to search your computer. And you have to have the capacity to support, you know, millions of searches, because these searches are always being propagated. But that's the model, and the model is you put this software on a computer large enough to handle it. We have my life over the last 2 years, excuse me, digital rights expression and management. I say my life over the last 2 years because for the EduSource project, I was the package manager for digital rights management. And I was I became that package manager for the specific purpose of making sure that digital rights management didn't overwhelm the EduSource project. I was only partially successful. But the idea of digital rights management, as I'm sure you know, is to tag or in some way mark digital objects in order to control their access, their distribution, their use. So you take a piece of digital content, you make sure it's stamped in just the right way, and that way only the good people can read your bit of content. The bad people who want to share it or something, they can't read your content. That's digital rights. I can talk, if you would like, and just ask a question if you would like. I talk all about digital rights expression managed languages and the shenanigans going on behind the scenes with this. And then learning activity sequences, content design. If you're familiar with something called IMS, Instructional Management Systems, their big product over the last year or so is something called learning design. And learning design is a way of structuring the display of learning resources or learning objects to the learner. And the idea of learning design is you set it all up like it's a big flowchart. And the model that they use is of a play. And so the student is an actor in the play. And the learning design is like the script of the play. And there are different roles in the play. And the instructor or the teacher is like the director of the play. And everybody plays their roles, and the student follows the script. And sometimes the script branches depending on what's happening. Sometimes it goes through loops or whatever. Is my voice that bad? Thank you. Oh, what great timing. Because I was scratching a bit. And it gives all of you a chance to get half a breath, because I'm just sort of trying not to be monotone here. So do feel free to interrupt. I don't want you to not feel free to interrupt, because I'm not that fascinating. Anyhow, learning design. But you see the picture. You should have the overall picture. And like, what we're doing is we're taking the existing institution in up to and including the size of it and the complexity of it, and we're basically stamping it in digital. So we got copyright. We've got our buildings all tightly linked. We've got the frameworks. We've got the libraries. All of that sort of stuff. That's the state of the art. If you don't like what I'm saying, go to this page and you can follow that picture. And these links here will give you the complete picture. It really was a very good conference. Well, how do I want to say this? You see, what happens when you have a new technology is it gives you new opportunities that you didn't have. And the word of the day these days is affordances. It's the meme that's traveling through the instructional sector. So I had to throw it in my slides. And you saw how it stopped me, because I'm not used to dealing with memes of the week. But the idea here is that our technology, internet technology specifically, because that's where I hang my hat, is internet technology, gives us the capacity to do things that we couldn't do before. And to me, the proof of that is that I'm here. Because this never would have happened pre-internet days. I would have heard of Darwin, because Darwin is actually mentioned in a couple of books that I've read. But to actually communicate with people, much less travel here, pre-internet, never would have happened. I've listed, and this is not a random list. What I tried to do is I tried to create a list on this slide that matched up with the list on the previous slide. Of the affordances that, or the new opportunities that internet technology gives us. Autonomy. We can have basically the world in our computer. This thing does everything. Well, okay, it doesn't make my breakfast. But everything I need to do is on this thing. Web server, content creation, you name it. Well, I'm recording audio, and I hope it's still working. It probably is, although I was trying to get it to tell me how much time I had left, and it wouldn't. So, choice. Think of the choice. I thought TV was restricted in my country, and I came here, and there's like 8 channels, and I'm sort of going, where are all the channels? But the internet, even 100 channels isn't a lot when you compare it to the internet. That gives us 1 billion, 2 billion, however many channels of information. All kinds of choice. Power. The internet allows us to distribute the tasks across a large number of computers. A lot of the stuff that we do with the internet would be impossible without this. There is a type of computing, which I'm sure many of you have heard about, called grid computing, which actually shares processing across a number of different computers. And if you've heard of SETI at home, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence at Home, that's a classic example of grid computing. But I'm thinking something even a little more basic. Just imagine what it thinks, what kind of computer power it takes to host a 1 billion web pages. Imagine trying to put them all in one computer or put them all in one building. You know, unless you're Google, you couldn't do it. Affordances, nearly free content. Well, actually, it pretty well is free. I say nearly free because I had to pay for this puppy and I have to pay to log on. So, you know, it's not completely free, but it's pretty close to free. It's a lot cheaper than it would be if I bought it in hardcover. And again, I'm talking about a 1 billion book library here that I have access to. So I don't even want to think about how much that would cost me in the old way. And other things, shared spaces. I grew up in the world of MUDs. If you're wondering what that is, a MUD stands for multi-user dungeon. That's old technology. That's simple technology. I love MUDs. And, of course, I had to sanitize it when I started talking about it in the academic circles. So MUDs started to stand for multi-user domain. Much better. But basically, it's a place where it's an entirely text-based world. You log on to this, and it puts you inside a system where you can chat with other people and move around in what they call rooms. And you move around, and then you go around trying to kill monsters, find treasure, chat with friends, sometimes kill friends, depends on what the what kind of MUD it was. There's a whole world of MUDs out there, and I cut my teeth on MUDs. Virtual worlds, simulations, all of that, and what's key about these, they're all open. Open-ended. There's not a direction. Even MUDs, they give you a quest, but if you just want to sit there and chat, you can just sit there and chat. Or, you know, you can progress through all the levels and be very directed if you want. Doesn't matter. There's no route to follow. You just wander wherever. Simulations, all of these things, they're open. They're loose. We lose the one-dimensionality that characterizes the text-based world. You read a book, you can't just take your words at random. Well, you can, and I've done that, but trust me, the plot really falls apart. But you can do that online. You can pick one website at a time. There's no order. In a MUD, pick whatever room you want to go to, especially if you're a wizard. You don't have to go through doors and passageways and risk the traps and things like that. So, we have two things. We have the state of the art, which I've just described. And we have the affordances, all the neat things we can do with computers. And, as the slide says, you can't get there from here. The state of the art, as I've just described it, with all of these big systems and tight interoperability, doesn't get us to the affordances. Simply emulating the educational system in a digital form will not allow us to take advantage of all the things that the internet allows us to do. So, this is why they're calling me heathen and calling me witch, because I'm going to these places, and a lot of people who stake their careers or, you know, at least spend a lot of time doing things like learning management systems and learning objects and federated searches and things like that. And I'm coming along and saying, this isn't the game. But trust me, this isn't the game. In fact, the state of the art, point for point, which is why I tried to line up these 5 points, point for point, the state of the art is exactly contrary to the affordances offered to us by the internet. Makes you wonder. So, what is the way forward? This is the main topic of my talk. Oh, I got lots of time. I lose track of the time. I actually bought a pocket watch just for this trip because I figured losing track of time 16 times in a 28-day period would be kind of bad for sanity, so I bought a watch. But I wouldn't buy a wristwatch because that's just conceding too much. Here's where we're going, and we're already on the way. 5 steps forward. Learning objects. Talk about learning objects has been around for a while. People still can't agree on the definition. The typical view is something like digital resources used to support learning. Something like that. Now, for me, I've keyed in on the word used, and in my definition of learning objects, anything can be a learning object, including, famously, a tissue paper. The key thing is that it's used to support learning. Something becomes a learning object if and only if it is used to support learning. Until that point, it's just something else. Well, once you have repositories, once you have learning objects, it becomes fairly obvious you need a place to put them, because otherwise they'd all be on the floor. So we have learning object repositories. And this is where a lot of the new work in the field is going today. IMS, which I mentioned before, came out with its DRI, Digital Repositories Specification, where it describes exactly how an online service should provide search service access to and delivery of learning objects to a remote system, such as a learning management system. And there's been a lot of talk about repositories, and the repositories are now getting built. People have been working on those over the last couple of years, and they're being rolled out. You see Aetna. Aetna has, in my mind, probably as advanced a repository system as exists in the world. I'm not just being nice to Aetna. It's really true. They were the first ones to actually come out with a national repository network, and we were very close in Canada, and we had a working system, but we had nothing like a system that people could use, because we built reference implementations. Okay, but there we are. But now we hit the sort of sticking point, because the next step forward is you've got your learning objects, and you've got your repositories, so you're sort of setting up your network. Now you've got to get the traffic moving through your network, because it is, after all, a network, right? It's not the Wall Street Journal. So the next step, I will loosely call at this point the talk syndication. Now, if you go to Aetna, or if you go to Merlot or whatever, and you say syndication, I'll say, what? Because that's not what they have in mind. They have in mind search and retrieval and digital rights, and let's make sure you don't share anything you're not supposed to. Syndication is a much looser concept than that. Syndication, that's the word that we use for sharing But I don't want to say sharing rather than syndication because it sounds like communist. So I say syndication, it sounds like, oh yeah, television networks, newspapers, those are okay. And that, if you think of newspapers and television and the way they syndicate, you sort of get the idea. But even after that, even once we've got the traffic moving through the system, now we're well beyond the current state. We're looking at personalization. We're looking at access to this network that is unique to you. And you might think that's really difficult to do, but it's actually very simple in certain respects. We already have personalization in many places where it counts. Your bank card, for example, is personalized, and you really want it to be personalized. Your telephone number, your email address, there are many ways of personalizing things. And then finally, the end point, the type of e-learning where we're able to draw on the affordances offered by the internet, what I characterize as learning environments, what people like Seymour Papert and James Paul G characterize as games, but something like that. I call them learning environments because my thinking is a little more open-ended. Because I'm perfectly happy to have a place where somebody logs on and just sort of sits there and does nothing. To me, that's still okay. The key point, of course, is step three. Step three, syndication. Because we need to make the leap in our mind from the theory of learning resources as being like books that are kept in libraries, that are stamped and loaned out. We need to get away from that idea of learning resources as something static and fixed. And we need to move to the idea of learning resources as something a lot more dynamic. I'm often asked to characterize, you know, what I think e-learning should be. Because people have this picture, and the, you know, the learning objects, people use the model of Legos and the model of atoms. It's always a model of things. Even the name. The name is derived from a concept in computing science called object-oriented programming. But the name, learning objects, seems to convey the idea of things. But looking forward, the idea, I think, should be more like learning objects or learning resources as being more like water that comes through our pipes or electricity that comes through our wires. Something that flows, something that's dynamic. You would never keep electricity in a library. In fact, the concept doesn't make sense. And it's that kind of difference between the network model and the broadcast model, the library model and the dynamic model. And the internet gives us the dynamic model, where we don't need to store things in libraries anymore. So, what's the sort? Did I skip a slide? Sorry. Oh yeah, okay, never mind. I'm just moving faster than I'm moving. I don't know if that makes any sense. Well, I used to study logic in university. I kind of needed that to be a philosopher. I'm not really natural at logic. In fact, when I started university, I was pretty bad at it. In fact, I had to take remedial mathematics in order to be entered into university. I had to take Math 101, and the details of which now escape me. But the thing with logic is, logic textbooks are written by logicians, which is what you would expect, right? And people who become logicians, you think about what they've done, right? They've gone through undergraduate, they've taken a master's, they've taken a PhD, they are completely devoted to the study of logic. And there are people like that. I've actually known some. And they have such a capacity in logic, they're experts in logic, it's like breathing to them. And these people write the textbooks. And so you get the textbook, and you look at the thing that they're trying to demonstrate, and it's, you know, if P then Q, P or not Q, for all P, Q, 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 therefore obviously P or not 2. And like there's 14 steps they've skipped. And to them it's a nice, smooth, intuitive transition, because everybody knows, but of course to me, I'm sitting there, how did he do that? But anyway, I've just done that to myself here. Where I've gone from one slide to the next slide, and I realize I've become as bad as my logic teachers. Anyhow, but that said, and of course my inference, I've just done it to you. So I'll just take a drink of water here and dig myself out of this hole. The examples of the kinds of things that I'm talking about when I talk about the network model of learning resources rather than the library model are stated in these on this slide here. The classic example, the one I've studied a great deal, the one I've written about a lot, is the weblog. How many of you are familiar with the weblog? Okay, the rest of you who did not put up your hand, are you really not familiar or just not putting up your hand? Well, I'm sorry, I shouldn't ask that. A weblog is like a website. However, a weblog is organized in reverse chronological order. That is to say, the owner of a website puts content onto that site on a regular basis. That content is dated, and the most recent content is displayed first. So when you go to a weblog, it'll say, you know, like today's the 24th, September 24th. And then you scroll down a bit, September 23rd. And you scroll down a little bit, September 22nd, and so on. That's all a weblog is. Now, what makes a weblog nifty and unique is that the technology to produce a weblog has become so simple that small children produce them. As part of an article that I wrote recently, I interviewed people at a place called Saint-Joseph, which is a school in Quebec City, and they have their entire class of grade fives creating weblogs. And I consider that a little old, you know, you should start sooner, but that's where they started. A weblog, to create a weblog, basically, you can go to a site like blogger.com and create an account. You just put your name in there and a password, and then it presents you with the screen. Basically, the title and a big box where you type your entry. So you title it, you tell, you know, today in Darwin. Today I was in Darwin. It was hot. It didn't rain. I had some stuff to do in the evening. I forget what it was. And then you hit enter, and you're done. And the system takes what you've done, and it creates a new entry, and it updates your weblog, and it dates it automatically for you, and puts it in a nice format and all that. It's very simple technology to use. It's hugely popular. There are approximately 4 million active weblogs out there now, the vast majority of which are run by young people, like very young people. Weblogs have been caricatured in the press, especially traditional newspapers and that, as being basically the personal diaries of angst-ridden teenage girls. And they actually write that, and that's why I put that in the slide. But weblogs are not characterized by their content. There are people from all walks of life that keep weblogs on all kinds of topics. I run what is sometimes called a weblog. It's a newsletter, or I call it a newsletter, called OL Daily. I publish it, not daily, as the name would seem to suggest, but 5 days a week, because I take weekends off. But again, the format's very similar. You see the dated entries and every day. Many other people, there's an academic community of researchers and technologists of about 300, 400 people, I can't really keep track, produce weblogs. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of teacher weblogs and countless thousands of student weblogs out there already. In the United States, political weblogs are big. I fell off the face of the earth, and so the story just sort of dropped. But when I was back in Canada, there was a big story about the CBS memos. Have any of you heard of that? Okay, no? Okay, she's seen it. Big story. CBS, 60 Minutes, comes online with these memos that they have saying that people pulled strings to help George Bush get into the National Guard so he wouldn't have to go to Vietnam and get shot at like everyone else. I think that's a smart thing to do, to not get shot at. Personally, I prefer not being shot at. Anyhow, but of course, you know, it's U.S. politics, so, you know, these memos had a big impact. So CBC runs this 16. They have the memos. Here are the memos. Well, the weblog community took over. And they analyzed these memos up and down and backward and forward. And it was just a day or so ago that I saw that CBS comes out. Well, maybe they're fake. After all, we can't prove that they're real. We're really sorry. And that's just the latest thing that weblogs have done to American politics. I mean, they've forced, was it the Speaker of the House? Or I forget who it was. Some major politician to resign because he made some somewhat off-color remarks at a fundraiser. And so traditional journalists are sort of looking at weblogs and they're like, what's going on here? Because as it turns out, if you take 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, a million people, and you have them all looking at a subject from every which angle, it's actually better news coverage than a journalist going in there and looking at it from his perspective. It's actually much better news coverage. And so journalists are very nervous about this. So, but the key point here with weblogs is it's easy technology. It's simple technology. It's low-tech technology. Anybody can do it. It's low bandwidth. The software, you either access a free site like blogger.com, or you can access free software like WordPress and install it on your own server. It's that kind of technology. And if you look at weblogs, there's no static state of weblogia. I just made that up. Actually, the name webloggers use for that world is the blogosphere. So there's no static state of the blogosphere. It's a constantly changing, swirling eddies and currents and so on and so forth. It's dynamic. And there have been a lot of writers talk about not just the way blogs are a new way of expression, but also of the way blogs have created a new type of community on the web, because bloggers read each other. I use Linux. There we go. They call it the recycle bin. But I don't want this stuff back. I don't know why they call it empty. Right. Why do they call it the recycle bin? This is stuff I really, truly want to get rid of. Okay, that was a ding. Yeah. And they do. Yeah, that's a good point. All right. We return to our previously chaotic program. I hope I deleted it. It was 299 media files, so I really wonder what I deleted. Now, the neat thing, how am I doing? Not too bad, but I got to rush a little bit. The neat thing about weblogs, and this is sort of, it came from a separate sphere. There's a thing out there called RSS. How many of you have heard of RSS? Okay, that's about what they said would be the rate. RSS stands for, according to some people, Rich Site Summary. According to other people, it stands for Really Simple Syndication. And according to other people, it's called ADAM, and it's not really RSS at all. But we won't worry about that. We'll just worry about RSS. And what RSS basically is a description in XML. You've all heard of XML, right? All right, good. A description in XML of a site like a weblog. And indeed, it's a description in XML of any website that'll have multiple bits of content or multiple items. It was originally designed for newspapers. And you have the newspaper, and it's called a channel for some obscure reason. And then you'd have a series of items, and each item would correspond to a story in the newspaper. And this would all be represented in XML. So you have, you know, the little item tag at the top, and the title, and link, and then description. And then RSS being RSS, you could add extra tags if you wanted, or you could ignore tags, because nobody could ever agree on the standard. There are actually something like, I don't know, 7, 9, 12 different versions of RSS. Nobody agrees on the standard. So anybody who writes software for it writes this, like, really loose, hacked together software that will accept any of these RSS and write a variety of RSS, and nobody really cares about getting the standard exactly. As long as it's XML and as long as it's close, it'll probably work. That's the world of RSS. Because it turned out that this standard that was created by Netscape back in 1997 or so to create personalized web pages for Netscape members, it was a site called NetCenter, and they were going to get all these newspapers to put their newspaper content. Well, as soon as that came out, like, ordinary people with websites started putting stuff in. I put an RSS feed into NetCenter. I'm very proud. My NetCenter number was 51, which means I was the 51st person in the world to have an RSS feed. And I feel sorry. I was slow, but, you know, I was busy. It turned out RSS worked brilliantly for blogs, because blogs are a site with multiple entries, right? So, now we have an XML format that works brilliantly for blogs. And we have software that makes blogging really easy. So, naturally, the software started creating the RSS feeds automatically. Now, for those of you who are into learning objects and learning object metadata, basically what happened in the blog community is the equivalent of easy authoring software for learning objects that does all of the learning object metadata automatically without you even thinking about it. The impact of that in the web blogging community was huge, because the idea of an RSS file is that it's machine readable. XML, right? So all the data is standardized, which means that these RSS files can be pulled together, or as they say, harvested by a computer program called a harvester, naturally, or an aggregator, and then they can do whatever with it. And whatever turns out to be things like, and it's linked on a page or two, Technorati, which allows you to search the entire blogosphere for any reference to, say, Tonga that happened today, or within the last 6 hours, or within the last hour. I use Technorati, naturally, to search for references to myself, because I'm like that. And you might think, that, well, that's pretty vain, and of course it is pretty vain, but I like to know what people are writing about me, so, you know, I can send hate mail back. But I have found that the best way to learn about my field is to find people who write about the same things that I write, and maybe even mention me in passing. I find all kinds of resources. It's this blogging community, right? RSS creates a million channel television system that you can subscribe to each and every channel individually, all those channels that you want, only those channels that you want. And if you're tootling around on the internet later on this evening or whatever, look up a site called Bloglines. It's spelled the way it's pronounced, blog, B-L-O-G, lines, lines.com. And what Bloglines is a site that, once you set up an account, it allows you to subscribe to RSS feeds. Well, that's what they're called, feeds, right? An individual RSS file is called a feed because it's syndicated content, so it's like a content feed. See how the whole sense of content as being dynamic and changing, it infuses the vocabulary of RSS and blogging. So go there, and I'll type up a URL because you have to actually subscribe to a feed to get this kick, although they'll suggest some things to you, but they won't suggest mine. So I'll give you the address, and you can type that in as a feed to subscribe to. And the neat thing about blog lines is, if you subscribe to a feed, or more than one feed, blog lines looks at the content of those feeds, because they are, after all, machine readable, and then suggests other feeds that are related. It's kind of cool. I subscribed to some stuff, and blog lines turned around and recommended my own feed to me. Open Archives Initiative is doing for the world of academic journals what blogs and RSS are doing for the world of angst-ridden teenagers. Open Archives Initiative, in combination with, well, you don't really need any other software, but basically the idea is university professors or college professors that write academic papers. Is your tape about to run out? All right. Do you want me to stop now?
No, that's okay. I have another
10 minutes. So I got them up. It's under the gun right now. I have lots of fun with people who record things. Right. College professors or university professors, you know how, the way it used to work, right? What would happen is you'd write a paper, you'd submit it to an academic journal, and three of your friends would read the paper and give it the thumbs up. And at that point, you would give complete and full copyright of your paper to that journal. Now, they haven't paid you anything. They haven't paid your friends anything either. In fact, they haven't paid anyone anything. But now they own your paper. And they take your paper and they print it in the journal, and then they charge your university $10,000 a copy in order to subscribe to this journal, and so that your colleagues can read the paper that you wrote. That's the old way. And I may sound like I'm exaggerating, but that's exactly how the system works, except I understated the price of it. And so various, and they're moving this to the online world, right? Because we have these repositories and these federated search networks and authentication and IP verification and lockdown content and digital rights. And the whole point of these is to make sure only fully paid up subscribers get to read these academic articles. And there were various professors out there, myself included, who noted that, gee, all of this research was paid for by the taxpayers of Canada or Australia or the United Kingdom or whatever, and perhaps the people who actually paid for this research ought to have the right to read it. And so they decided that in a world where we do live, such that content is nearly free, and seeing as nobody in the academic community was being paid for this stuff anyways, they just started putting it up on their website for free. An Open Archives Initiative is a way of taking these papers, creating metadata to describe these papers. Again, just another XML file. OAI uses a metadata format, an XML format called Dublin Core, and describes these papers, and then it makes the descriptions of these papers available for harvesting in exactly the same way blogging software makes an RSS feed available for harvesting. And so they're just in the process now, and it's still early days for OAI, but early days, there's something like 1 million papers that are available through OAI now. There are journals, such as the Public Library of Science, that are being founded specifically on the open access model. And they are just beginning to build aggregators and services that will harvest this data and make it available for search. There's a site out there called OAI Stir, Oyster, it's so cute. That's a good example of something like that. all kinds of other initiatives. Instant messaging, you should talk about dynamic content. Wikis. A wiki is a site that looks just like an ordinary web page with the small distinction that anybody in the world can edit that web page. And yet you might think, how could you possibly pull that off? But there's a site out there, if you're tooling on the computer, look up a site called wikipedia.org. It's like encyclopedia, only Wikipedia. That's an online encyclopedia. It's inside a wiki. And Wikipedia, just this week, in fact, published its 1 millionth article. There have been some studies comparing Wikipedia with Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, obviously, it has more articles, many, many more articles. The content is more or less equally authoritative. The information in Wikipedia is as likely to be correct as the information in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And Wikipedia is used by more people. And if you think about it, anybody can edit a page. Anybody can go in and put anything into a page in a wiki. But as it turns out, if you make that possible, the content of the page will trend toward a statement that everybody agrees to about whatever topic is on that page. Because if anybody can change the page, you're not going to put something stupid in it, because the next person will just take it out. So you have to put content that other people will leave in the page. I could go on about Wikipedia, but I don't have a whole lot of time. Completely uncensored. So you can put in offensive material, but the thing is, the lifespan of offensive material on Wikipedia can be measured in seconds. So it's better. It's certainly better than email, where the lifespan of offensive material appears to be forever. Other tools, I don't have time, but there's a whole set of free open source content management tools. PostNuke, Drupal, there's others, but there's Plone. There's more. There's even an open source learning management system called Moodle, which is a little peripheral to this discussion. But what I'm after are these open source content management systems, because these systems, again, create automatically RSS feeds. And so the contents of these things, Scoop is another one, they look and feel like newspaper sites when you go, and you probably wouldn't even know you're in one of these sites when you look at it, but it's generating this metadata automatically. It's incredibly easy to use, and it's this fluid, dynamic, ever-changing world of RSS feeds and content management. It is so totally unlike learning object libraries. Old and new. Old linear. New multi-threaded. Old content delivery. New something immersive, something interactive. An environment, a simulation, a pool of RSS content. Old static. Paste. Think about the learning that you're doing online right now. New dynamic. Unpaced. Open-ended. Old demonstration. New experience. Old learner objectives or learning objectives, new learner goals. And I would say they're old institution directed, institution centered, new learner directed, learner centered. Old, always have to motivate the students, right? New, you're responding to the students' desires, their interests, their needs. Spot the Pigeon is the name of an album by a group called Genesis. And Genesis got the name of the album from a feature that was run in British newspapers called Spot the Football, And what they would do is they would take a picture from the weekend sports games without the football in it. And then the readers would write in and try to say, you know, where the football went. Because you look at the whole scene, right, and you try to judge, you know, the players' expressions, where they're looking, where the motion is, where must the ball be? Well, where must the pigeon be? Federated search, you have to have these big, large servers with Java and Tomcat and Excite and Cocoon or whatever, just in order to join the... You've got to buy a house, basically, to just get into the network. The search is, as I said earlier, are propagated through the network. So for any one search, it might be a dozen, two dozen, or whatever searches. And the whole network as a whole is handling these millions of searches. In the federated system, all the metadata is held tight by each member of the federation. That's why you, the searcher, have to go to them. But that means the only person, the only organization that describes a resource is the organization that's trying to sell it. Now, if you think about that, there are certain weaknesses in that plan. It's sort of like if you went to buy a car, and the only place you could learn about cars was from the car manufacturers, and you could never read car reviews or anything like that. Harvest search. Let me give you an example of a harvest search that you might have heard of. It's a little company, although they recently bought Blogger. They're called Google. Google is classic harvest. You don't need any credentials to join the Google network. Google will come and take whatever data you offer them. There's a single search point. You go to Google, you do one search, it runs in one place, you get your results right away. Federated searches, and anybody who doubts me on this can go try some, are characterized by incredibly slow search results because, of course, your search is propagated. Harvest search allows for multi-party ratings of resources. Google has its page rank, which is a system of organizing the results according to, among other things, the number of pages that link to the pages that you're looking at. It's a different talk, but there's a whole field out there under the heading of recommender systems. And if you want to follow this up, go to Google and look up recommender systems. It talks about how third parties can evaluate online resources and organize them and make them available to people. And there are recommender systems in music. There are recommender systems for books. Amazon has recommender systems for books, for example. There are recommender systems for people. They're called dating services. I thought that might get a titter. Spot the pigeon, right? Which way is the world going? As I said, the federated search is a single layer. You search, that's it, you're done. The aggregated search is multi-layer. You produce a resource, somebody harvests it, it gets talked about. Somebody else harvests the discussion, it gets talked about. The information about the one resource propagates through the system. I like to think of it as layers, right? It's layers of information about a single resource. So the resource and then first layer of discussion, second layer. There's a book out there published by O'Reilly called Google Hacks. And what Google has done is made available a mechanism for integrating the results of a search right into a piece of software. It's called the Google API. And people have had all kinds of fun with Google. Sometimes pretty silly things, right? Like you put in a search to Google and the Google results come back, but they're all in pirate speak. You have a lot of fun. My own contribution to this, and this is, I've taken more time getting to this point because I can't stop here and show you, but if you follow the links on this, I have a thing called EduRSS. And what EduRSS does is I've selected about 300 or so blogs and other resources that are focused specifically on the field of instructional technology. And my system harvests the RSS feeds for that. And then what EduRSS does is it analyzes this content and then produces 107 topic-specific feeds. So I have, for example, a feed on Australia. I have a feed on learning objects. I have a feed on aggregators, a feed on accessibility, so on and so forth. I won't read out all 107 because I don't remember them all. So the idea is, if you use something like blog lines or a desktop aggregator, like, say, NewsGator or Amphetadesk, can't be held responsible for the names they give these things, you could subscribe not to the original blogs, but to an EduRSS feed. But say you chose learning objects, then you would be receiving every day everything that was written about learning objects that day by a pool of 300 or so educational technologists. It's an incredible resource. I do have a feed that covers all of EduRSS, but question. Pardon? The learning, well, EduRSS itself will come up with several hundred items a day. That takes a long time to read through. The learning objects, turns out learning objects is a small field. Who knew? You might get one or two items a day. And what happens is, you don't have to search for them. So the content comes straight to you, so whatever it was that's produced that day, even on a busy day, you've saved yourself hours. Imagine what it would take to search through 300 sites to find out if something new was added. So, and it really varies depending on the subject. Australia, which is one of my topics, you might get 5 or 6 items a day on. So it'll take a bit longer, right? And the idea, and I haven't done this yet, but the idea of EduRSS is now, because I can sort the output by topic, now I should be able to tweak those topics so that you get a personalized feed from EduRSS bringing you all and only the information you want. And thus we would move right to step 4, personalization. I'm not there yet. I'm working on it. Having issues with the login and authentication, because I really don't like login and authentication, because there's no reason why I should track everything you read. There's no good purpose for it. So how do you do login without a login? That's the dilemma I'm facing.
You said that you have an EduRSS that runs every day. What happens if it misses a day?
Actually, it runs every hour, and it doesn't miss a day. It runs automatically. I don't do anything.
Okay.
It's all, and that's the beauty of it. It's completely automatic. I set it up. The only thing I do is I choose the list of sites that I harvest from. And I do that very deliberately. Technorati or Feedster are sites that do a similar sort of thing, but they harvest everybody. And it's really hard to get topic-specific feeds from them because, like Edna, for example, I have a feed that's specific to Edna. Well, imagine if you're harvesting everything in the world, what a feed called Edna would look like. You know, Edna Krabappel and Edna, well, I don't know what Ednas there are out there, but there are many. Edna on my system means one and only one thing, because when people in our field talk about Edna, they're talking about Edna, which to somebody outside our field will sound really stupid, but we'll leave that aside. So I tend to the list of sites that gets harvested. It's kind of like a bonsai tree, right? And I trim a little here, trim a little. I'm very careful with my little selections and so on. The thing about this is, I do EduRSS. Other people should be able to do the same thing, right? Why should EduRSS be the only thing in the world that does that? That would be silly. Excuse me. So, you can actually have a large number of services like EduRSS harvesting feeds on whatever topic. Beekeeping. You have a BRSS. This sounds Buddhist or something. BRS. I heard mod 60s. Whatever. BRSS. Or, history of I don't know, Fiji. You have HIST-FIJI RSS. You can have very topic-specific RSS aggregators. And what's happening here is we're creating a network that begins to organize itself with very minimal intervention on the part of people who tend to the network. And they tend to the network, they tend to their own particular part of the network very carefully, like they would a bonsai tree. And the characteristic of this, think about the technology that's putting this together. The blogging software, which is very simple technology. The harvesting software also turns out to be very simple technology. To harvest an RSS feed, I wrote a program in a language called Perl. The actual harvester itself, the piece of software that brings the resource in and parses it and looks at what it contains, is actually about 40 or 50 lines of code, as compared to the millions of lines of code in Windows. A very simple technology. And I wrote it in Notepad, right? Of course. And that's all that you need to make one of these systems work. OAI, the software is written in Perl. It's much larger code. It's up to about, 400 or 500 lines. It's like that. It takes a little bit to understand it, but it's very simple to use, actually. It installs very simply. You don't need special software. You don't need Windows. Now, that's EduRSS, and I thought, well, learning objects have learning object metadata, and one day they will actually have a piece of software that creates learning objects. So I created something called DLearn, which does exactly the same thing for learning objects. It's called the Distributed Learning Object Repository Network. And the idea is people out there have learning objects. They describe their learning objects in RSS. DLearn harvests that RSS. It organizes it into topics and it makes it available. That's much easier than a federated search. And there's no overhead. And it's low technology. That exists now. That software is available. I haven't released it, but if you write it to me, I'll send it to you. I haven't recently because I'm not a very good coder, so it's kind of ugly software. I want people to do nice commercial jobs. Actually, Thompson came up with a product called Urchin fairly recently, which requires Perl. Specifically, it requires mod Perl 2 and an Apache 2 server, so it's a little specific, too specific for me, but it's a very high-powered harvesting system along the model of EduRSS and DLearn. You might want to look into that. So, you sort of imagine where this stuff is going, right? Think dynamic, think low-tech, think, you know, you're thinking about the future of learning resources, think more in the line of blogs than of learning objects, more in the line of RSS than learning object metadata, more in the line of, I've run out of examples, but you know what I mean. I have more slides, so I have more words, boy. So, I can't show you this, but, IMS landed on my desk in 1997. It was about this thick, and landed with a satisfying thud. That was 7 years ago. We still don't have a standard way of writing learning objects. Isn't that bizarre? Who's responsible for that? If you go to this site here, on this slide, what that site is an example of how learning objects should work. If you think about it, text-based. Let's write our learning objects in simple XML code. Put them right in XML to begin with. And then that will give us the capacity to use other simple technologies like XSLT to style and present these learning objects. And again, if we do it that way, we can pretty loose the standard. The big system integration, that row over there laughed when I talked about integration, it's not going to work. All of it work for short periods of time for non-mission critical applications, but the minute you count on it, it's going to crash. And we know this because our networks crash, and the more tightly integrated we try to get our software applications, the more likely they are to crash. And the more likely it crashes to cascade. That's what happens to Windows, right? If one little piece goes wrong in one little program, and it takes out your hard drive. And it sends a nasty message to the president. So you'll see that example there on that site. But basically, my advice to you now is be ready for, or for those of you who already know, help build a blogger of e-learning. A simple application. It's coming one way or another. If you are decision makers in this room, think very carefully before investing in large learning management systems or large learning object authoring systems. Think very carefully, because there will be a blogger of e-learning. It's going to happen. Dollars to donuts, it's going to happen. Practical steps. I can't pronounce that word. I put it in there because it sounds so good. But I'm not going to try to pull it off. But spending time on money and money on major LMS systems is, in my mind, like trying to patch the Titanic.
Start again.
If you must use a learning management system, try to use an open source system like Moodle, or there's Saki, S-A-K-A-I, which is something coming out of the States. Although that's all Java and stuff, so it might be more than you really want. Expect and demand, and I mean demand, true content syndication. Not the thing that they call reusability in the learning management industry today, which is laughable. I wrote to Blackboard, can you export and import objects using RSS? And they wrote back saying, well, if you wrote a Java program that matched up with our API, then in theory it's possible. If whatever software that you're looking at requires something specific like Internet Explorer to run, then in my opinion, it's broken. And I know that this is something that's impacting on some of the things that some of you use. I'm not going to name them. And some of the things that some of you have designed. But seriously, if you have to use Internet Explorer, the thing is broken. It should be fixed. Practical steps. Start building small pieces. Think small pieces. Little bits of content. Anything that you know about that's useful, doesn't have to be big. It can just be blog posts, whatever. Build little small pieces. Because once we get small pieces being built, people will see in the field of learning the way they have already seen in the field of blogging this content flow. And they'll begin to see the usefulness of learning object aggregation, learning object syndication. I recommend that you learn XSLT. XSLT has been around for a while. It's been noticeably useless for the last 5 years or so. It is now useful because the new browsers, Firefox, which you should be running instead of Internet Explorer, and Internet Explorer now support more or less fully XSLT, which means that Firefox and Internet Explorer can take content written in XML and present it as HTML. So it'll give you a lot more flexibility. XSLT is where a lot of our interoperability will come from. Explore things like blogs, wikis, and the content management systems like PostNuke, Drupal, Clone, and others. If you offer content, think about and then actually offer an RSS feed for that content. And if you do offer an RSS feed for your content, tell me about it, and I'll put it into my network. And if you don't want to tell me about it, at least go to BlogLines and subscribe to your own RSS feed, and then BlogLines will start suggesting other resources that are similar to the stuff that you produce. If Extensible style sheet language transformation. Now, what that is it's a type, it's, and you know what an XML file is, right? It has a whole bunch of tags. What an XSLT file does is it tells your browser to go through the XML file, and anytime it sees a tag of a certain sort, to put something different there. So I could have, for example, a simple XML file, title, Stephen Downs title, and the XSL could say, title, question mark, well that's not quite right, but title, H1, whatever the thing is, slash H1. If you apply that XSLT to that XML, the resulting output would be H1, Stephen Downs, H1. So it does a transformation on the XML document. And what's neat about it is the same XML document with different XSLT can be used to create PDFs, Word, Braille, or maybe not Braille, but more accessible types of content, as well as HTML. So it's a very powerful technology. You can also use XSLT to do things like extract only parts of XML documents and variations on the theme, things like XPath and that allow you to search through XML documents for specific content. So there's a lot that's going to happen as a result of this. And what's neat about it, you can do it all with Notepad. I'm sure Microsoft hates it, but there you go. Practical steps 3. I recommend, for more reasons than I can cover in this short talk, that you embrace open access. No, if for no other reason than content is no longer financially viable as a business model. And if you think it is, I have many arguments to tell you that you're wrong. The calculations that I've done, and these have held out, is that the value of content is 2 times order of magnitude lower than what it was in the pre-internet days. A course that cost $100, $1. A book that cost $10, 10 cents. A piece of music that cost $1, 1 cent. And that's where we're heading. And I know we are heading this way. They are giving away music tracks, MP3 tracks, in McDonald's to sell hamburgers. Think about it. So you might as well embrace it. And if you embrace it, that allows the information to flow through this network that I've just been describing. It's what makes content, including educational content, more like water and electricity and less like stones. Open source software, I go on for a long time about that, but if you're using Internet Explorer, go to Google and look up a browser called Firefox. Firefox does everything Internet Explorer does, but without the pop-ups and the viruses. And finally, think about the network as a network. There's a whole field of study out there now called social networking, and sometimes also called small worlds network. There's a book by Duncan J. Watts, 6 Degrees, will get you started. And if you look up on Google Watts, you'll find quite a bit of other material on the same subject. Network theory, as such, has only really come into prominence in the last 5 years or so. And it's good stuff. So that's basically the recommendation. Here's the website that I told you to check for on my website to find out where my website is. So if somebody in this room actually writes it down, then you'll all know. And you will be able to find, as soon as I can upload it, this presentation with all of the links, plus various other materials. Eventually, the audio of this talk in MP3, and I'll try to get it down below 60 megabytes, as well as audios from all of the other talks that I've done in Australia and other papers and so on. All of the content all of the photos, all of the audio on my website. Do whatever you want with them. Use them, reproduce them, send them to your friends, send them to your enemies. The only thing I ask is you don't sell them. They're not commercial. They're free, they're open access, they're there for you to use. So that's everything I have, and that's all the time I have. Thank you.
We'll do a bit of a question session next. If people have got any questions, not exhausted his larynx just yet, but he might have slaked all our thirst already.
Sure, go for it.
Stephen, you're talking about your recommendation for learning objects and the creation of learning objects and moving away from that to something that's a little bit more useful and can be collected in a repository and better, and saying, okay, from now on let's create things that can be harvested much easier. What about the significant amount of money that's gone into things that have already been created? How do we collectively put all those eggs in the one basket along with this new stuff?
Okay. Let me clarify. Learning objects are not intrinsically bad. Okay, it's just if we get hung up on the specific thing that the industry is now calling learning objects, that's bad. So what I'm saying is, not instead of learning objects, we should do such and such, but in addition to or alongside. Because I'm the last person who wants all the money we've spent on learning objects to be wasted. This is still good content. If you go to DLearn, you can actually search, because DLearn harvests Edna, it harvests Merlot, you can actually see thousands of learning objects through there. And there's a lot of good stuff there. But people get too hung up about making sure that the 87 IAMS fields are filled out. You don't need all that metadata. If you have all that metadata, great, wonderful. But if you have a title and a location, you're probably away to the races anyways. And the librarians are wincing. But it's true. All you need for metadata, all you need is enough stuff to get it into the system. The system, the users of the learning object will describe your object much better than you can, because they know how they used it, and you don't. So my main thing is get stuff into the system. And don't be picky about it being compatible with Blackboard or compatible with WebCT. I would say try to make it simple, XML if possible, HTML if not, and just try right now, go for volume. Quite seriously, go for volume rather than going for high tech, multimedia, all of that, because the world isn't ready to deal a lot with these things yet. I've been in this, and I'm just now playing with audio and a little bit of video, and the complaints are coming in, right? Because people don't have the bandwidth. So I don't need nasty email from Brazil. So I think going for simple content, fairly tightly constrained, a lot like learning objects. I mean, learning objects, the concept wasn't wrong. It's the way the concept got rolled out, and it became part of Microsoft Incorporated or IBM Incorporated or Blackboard Incorporated. The very simple idea of simple things that could be exchanged and shared became this really difficult thing to do. And, you know, think blogs rather than the other stuff. So that's kind of what I'm saying. The complicated stuff, not broken, just not as useful as everyone thought. So it wasn't wasted after all. But if you bought big, huge LMSs, it's a different story.
What about if you're dealing with students who are ESL or they don't have very good English skills, and so reading a lot of text on screens and web stuff isn't necessarily the best thing for them, and therefore with our sort of e-learning process, it's looking at more other ways, like with video and audio and stuff like that, which you're saying is actually, you know, look like that's more acceptable for them. Yeah, is there a middle ground or a way that you can address that?
For audio, I try to use low bandwidth formats if possible. I mean, I'd like to sit here and recommend Ogg Vorbis, which is an open audio format, except almost nobody can play it, so that's an issue with the software that's installed on their computer. I use audio because, you know, there are a lot of people for whom the audio track makes the difference. The talk I did in Utah had a certain impact. The audio that I did of the talk had a much bigger impact. So it's there. You know, again, we're transition, and we're at this state where we're going to go from almost no bandwidth to everyone having broadband. And it's going to happen in our lifetimes. Even my lifetime. It's pretty well happening in Canada now. Like 60% of Canadian households have broadband access. So, you know, I mean, it's happening. It's going to happen. India launched a satellite specifically designed for education, teacher training, resources, educational support. It's happening. It's happening all around the world. So, you know, and there isn't going to be a single rule, do such and such. You have to look at your target and pick your technology. That's the only rational thing to say that I can say. Pick the technology and target it. A lot of the people that you're working with, and people took pains to tell me this before I did my talk, right? You know, in the outback, the internet access is intermittent. We have to use CDs because, you know, I'm famously anti-CD. But if the internet access is intermittent, use CDs. I drove around, I set up in Manitoba. I did an online course. I did a whole online program. Beautiful. I wrote an LMS. I had all of this beautiful content. We rolled it out. People accessed it at community access centers throughout Manitoba. And the complaints started coming in. Can't load it. Too slow. And so I pulled an all-weekender. And I changed some of the programming in my LMS, and I recorded a bunch of CDs with all the high bandwidth content. And then I spent the next week driving around the province of Manitoba handing out CDs. I felt like Johnny Appleseed, Johnny CD, handing out CDs to support it, and it didn't solve the problem. Well, it solved that problem, but bandwidth was still an issue. But it was better, and sometimes better is what you hope for. So, you know, you know, advice, the advice from the expert, wing it. Seriously, that's the only way to do it. This, you know, the projector in Cairns, that was sitting on top of the box and propped up with some plastic bags and a little masking tape. Classic. And anyone who says they have the solution for everything is lying. And that's most vendors. Anything else? Well, I hope you enjoyed the talk, and I do want to say I appreciate all of you coming out coming here on a Friday night, especially with such beautiful weather, rather than going to wherever you would normally go on a Friday night. Just thank you so much for the welcome here. It's really been great. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Dave. I'd just like to thank Stephen officially and personally. It's been fantastic to see somebody talking about a lot of the really important issues in getting underneath the technology to think about some of the actual things like educational activities instead of focusing on the big bucks that are being spent on infrastructure and software that, according to Steve, it's taking us exactly where I think it's taking us, which is nowhere. So it's really been great for me to hear that, and hopefully for the rest of you, you've got something similar out of that experience, and it'll put a nice perspective on things as we go forward with e-learning and put us squarely and firmly focused back on the educational activities and the learning scenarios rather than on chasing some technology dream. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you.
Just before we